This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across our state this time of day. Today we're going to talk about something that's in the popular culture right now. There's a movie out called Boy Erased. It stars Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman, and it's about the son of a Baptist preacher who's forced to participate in a church-supported gay conversion program after being outed to his parents. So this is an intriguing topic to talk about with a professional, and we brought a professional in. Christy McGeorge is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at NDSU. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about this, first of all, in a sort of a broad overview. What is conversion therapy?
So it's a style of therapy that is geared at altering one's sexual orientation from being lesbian, gay, or bisexual to being heterosexual.
And that, is there any scientific or evidence base for this particular approach?
There's not. To be honest, there was a number of studies published over the years supporting such a practice. But as time went on, the researchers behind those studies had to recant them for reasons related to either falsifying their data or falsifying their sample.
Has it been proved in any circumstance to work?
There's really no data that supports that conversion therapy works in terms of altering one's sexual orientation from being that of a member of the sexual minority community to being that of the dominant sexual majority community.
So in a way, it sounds like there's this other idea out there that a gay person, maybe in an authority position, like a priest or a religious leader or a professor who is gay could maybe influence somebody who's heterosexual to be gay. That doesn't work the other way either, does it?
Well, that's interesting, because if reparative or conversion therapy actually worked, then there would be attempts to alter individuals' sexual orientation from heterosexual to gay. But again, it's only one directional, and so it reflects some societal biases that we have in our culture.
You talked about homosexual and heterosexual and bisexual. Are we really talking about a human behavior that's a spectrum as opposed to one or the other or this or that?
Most definitely. Certainly, since the 40s, we've understood sexual orientation as existing on a continuum. Kinsey was the first to kind of document this idea in his extensive research.
Is there any circumstance where conversion therapy, as you've described it here, might be useful to an informed adult? Because the movie we're talking about is about somebody who's not an adult yet.
Unfortunately, the research we do have on conversion therapy links it to increased rates of suicidal ideation attempts and completion, as well as increased rates of depression and anxiety. So given the outcome that we've been able to document through research, there's a real concern about this idea that it could be helpful. Certainly some have made that argument that based on client autonomy, if a well-informed adult comes and says, I'd like to alter my sexual orientation, why wouldn't therapists provide that? But given what we know about the impact of such a therapy, there's many things that clients seek from therapists that aren't helpful and are actually hurtful to them. We could use some examples that might seem extreme, but I've experienced in my own practice. So, for instance, I once had a woman come and say to me, I need help to better restrict my calorie intake. Clearly, she was struggling with anorexia nervosa, and certainly that's not help I would provide. I've also sat with a heterosexual man who asked me, I just need some better strategies to better control and keep in line my wife and children. Again, this isn't something I would provide, but comes from societal understandings of what it, in the first example, societal understandings of thinness, and I idealize thinness, and in the second example, some societal ideas about gender and this notion of head of household. And so clients frequently come seeking services that might not be helpful to them, and that's part of the role of a therapist, is to help them examine where the ideas and beliefs they have come from and how they might come from hurtful societal discourses.
This movie again, Boy Erased, this young man is forced to participate in this conversion program. Is that possible? Can you force somebody to do that?
Well, unfortunately with minors and the lack of rights that minors have in many states, we can require them or maybe forced may or may not be the right word, but in order to feel like they are loved and worthy and can stay within the family, they could be required, which for a young person feels like being forced, like their choices are taken away. And so historically and currently, we do see this with LGB young people and adolescents.
So more coercion than forcing somebody.
Yeah, and I think it's probably hard to feel like you have much choice and option when you feel like if you don't go through this therapy, you're going to be kicked out of your house, you're no longer going to be loved by your family. I mean, things that are really hard to comprehend.
Is this usually then conversion therapy used by parents with children? Is that the overwhelming majority of these cases?
That's a really good question. On some, there's not great data, current data, about who is seeking conversion therapy or who's being forced into conversion therapy. Historically, a lot of the programs were geared at late adolescents. And so we did see a lot of adolescents, but there have also been programs geared at adults.
One of the complications of this is that it sort of gets meshed with morals and religion, theology, if you will, and evidence-based science here. And we're talking about human behavior and the belief in some religions, for example, that any sexual contact is procreative in nature as opposed to recreative, if you will. So is that part of what muddies the waters here?
Certainly. Conversion therapy has a long history with connection to the Christian church and to different denominations within the Christian church. And there has been a source of struggle. While there are Christian churches that are very affirmative and accepting of the lesbian, gay, and bisexual community and have been for a very long time, there are still religious traditions that continue to hold on to ideas of damnation for those that have a lesbian, gay, or bisexual sexual orientation. And if your fear is that your child or your fellow congregant is going to be experience damnation or whatever your concept is of hell, certainly there seems like there needs to be an intervention so that salvation can be had. So you can see how it can come from a really well-meaning place, but unfortunately reflects a belief system that is really hurtful to the adolescents and adults.
And one that's imposed on somebody.
And one that is imposed on someone that tells them that they are less than or not as worthy.
Christy McGeorge is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at NDSU, a licensed marriage and family therapist. And we're talking about a phenomenon or a practice called conversion therapy. Is this usually related to a religious group?
The research does suggest that most of the individuals who practice conversion therapy are tied to a religious tradition that supports the practice.
Is this a business?
Certainly, as is all mental health services, there are fees associated with them. And so this is a business which has made it tied to some of the federal legislation that has been recently introduced to curtail its practice.
Because perhaps federal funds could be used to pay for it, like Medicare or Medicaid or something like that?
Certainly, we could think about both federal funds being used to pay for it as well as insurance and private funds being used. And so recently, back in April of 2017, two U.S. senators and a House of Representatives introduced the Therapeutic Fraud Prevention Act, which is focused on banning the practice of conversion therapy and the advertisement of conversion therapy, and particularly states that if it is passed, that money can't be received for such a therapeutic practice.
So the federal action is pending, but states have acted, right?
They certainly have. So 14 states and the District of Columbia have introduced and passed legislation banning the practice of conversion therapy for minors. At this time, no one has banned it for adults. Additionally, we have 47 counties and cities across the U.S. who, on a state level, it's not been banned, have banned it within their city or county.
We haven't discussed this yet. How is conversion therapy typically conducted, or are there variations of it?
There are variations of it. It is conducted both in an individual setting and in a group setting. And often the actual techniques, for lack of a better word, that are used are guarded quite closely and are not advertised in terms of what's been done. But the practices have ranged from some things that are particularly abusive, for instance, inviting having men who identify as gay watch basically what amounts to gay porn and then feel electric shock each time they become aroused.
So strong aversion therapy.
Aversion therapy to more cognitive behavioral therapy that's about changing cognitions related to sexual attraction.
And that would be talk therapy, typically?
More talk therapy there.
Are you aware of any conversion therapy being practiced in North Dakota?
I have been told about some therapists in our state that practice conversion therapy and have heard from some clients who have received conversion therapy, many of who were minors when they received it and now are adults and are speaking out against the practice.
Would you support legislation in the state of North Dakota to outlaw it?
I would. I would love to see North Dakota both join the other 14 states in banning the practice for minors, but we also could have the opportunity to be the first state to ban the practice for both minors and adults.
Do you have any direct experience with the practitioners of this kind of therapy?
I've done some research. I, along with some colleagues at NDSU, did one of the first studies in the U.S. There had been a larger study in 2009 in the U.K. focused on conversion therapists. But we did one of the first studies in the U.S. looking at conversion therapists, not just from North Dakota, but from across the United States.
And again, for our listeners, what did you find?
So we found probably three significant things. Why those who practice conversion therapy often make the argument that they're just like any other licensed clinician. We found that they were statistically different from other licensed clinicians who didn't practice conversion therapy, and in maybe ways that aren't fully surprising to the listeners. But first, we found that those that practiced conversion therapy or believed it was ethical to practice conversion therapy held much more homophobic beliefs and much more negative beliefs about the lesbian, gay, and bisexual community. We also found that this group of therapists, those that practice conversion therapy, reported much lower levels of competence to provide therapy to the LGB community. Conversion therapists often cite that the only reason they do it is because clients request it. It turns out that their own clinical competence was very different from those who didn't practice. We also found that, at least in our sample, and this reflects what was found in the sample in the UK, is that the majority of those who practiced conversion therapy or believed it was ethical identified also as men.
Mm-hmm. It sounds, although, you're describing a charlatan in many cases here, somebody who's pretending to be something, even though they might be licensed, but they're practicing a therapy that is highly questionable.
Yes, and it was interesting after years of hearing from conversion therapists that they're just like all other therapists. It was helpful to us to be able to document that they indeed are not. But again, we're talking about a practice that, if I described any other therapeutic practice with outcomes that increase mental health concerns, increase suicidal ideation, I think it would be fair to ask, why is that practice allowed? But yet conversion therapy has been shown to do just the opposite of what we as therapists are called to do, which is to do no harm, and not only to do no harm, but we're really called to do benefit in our clients' lives. And yet this practice gets to continue, even though it's been so harmful.
You have a doctorate in your discipline. You're licensed in your discipline. How do you think this would appear on a resume for somebody who had been involved in conversion therapy, presenting themselves, outside that particular practice? Would this not bode well for them?
That would almost be my hope. Maybe that's not kind to say, and I don't mean that unkindly, but I would hope that we would question and really ask people to justify how they had engaged in such a practice. I just fear that why it wouldn't be acceptable, for instance, to try to challenge or change someone's identity based on any other demographic factor. If I was doing therapy to help someone who was white identified, this is going to sound ridiculous, changed their racial identity to be that to someone who is African-American, people would think I was crazy and should. But yet we're talking about a demographic factor, sexual orientation in this case, that someone's trying to change, but yet we as a society allow some of that discrimination, because in so many ways it's still okay, unfortunately, discriminate against the lesbian gay community in certain circles.
About a year ago, a report came out from the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. This is a think tank on sexual orientation and gender identity law and public policy. And it said in its headline, more than 20,000 LGBT teens in the U.S. will be subjected to conversion therapy. Also, approximately 57,000 youth will receive treatment from a religious or spiritual advisor. And this research also found that approximately 700,000 LGBT adults in the U.S. have received conversion therapy at some time in their lives. That is jaw-dropping in terms of the size.
Completely. Completely jaw-dropping, and raises the need for both federal and state-level legislation to regulate this harmful practice.
You've mentioned this a couple of times, but let's underscore it. Young people who go through this are under increased risk, perhaps?
Increased risk for suicidal ideation, suicidal attempts, suicidal completions, as well as increased risk for depression and anxiety. We've also seen some increased risks of substance abuse. It's a way to numb and to deal with some of the outcomes of conversion therapy.
Is there a counter to it, reparative or restorative therapy, something? I mean, I assume there's a name for it.
We often call it LGBT affirmative therapy, which involves clinicians both embracing and celebrating LGBT identities and acknowledging the impact of heterosexism, homophobia, and heteronormative assumptions on the lives of LGBT individuals.
Have you administered this?
Yes. I have had the opportunity both to train other therapists in LGBT affirmative therapy and practice it myself, and think it's really important. As you said, based on the numbers from the Williams Institute, it's a really important therapy for people to be aware of and to be able to practice.
Are you basically reacting to like a post-traumatic syndrome disorder here? Is that what you're treating?
Well, in some ways it is. It's treating the rejection that has occurred, both the promotion of self-rejection, the rejection from that might have occurred based from family and from society, and helping people to get to embrace and celebrate who they are and who they were made to be.
So is this therapy sometimes family inclusive? Bring in everybody.
It can be really important to include the entire family in this process, and also to help the family examine some of the negative beliefs that they were taught from society. Again, we're often taught these beliefs about the inferiority. I don't believe this myself, but we are taught by society about the inferiority of LGBT individuals and the superiority of heterosexual individuals from infancy.
It's a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing, and a cultural thing that families need help challenging, not because they want to hold these beliefs, but because they've been indoctrinated into these beliefs by society. We all have.
Well, Christy McGeorge, thank you for shedding some light on this issue for us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Christy McGeorge is a professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at NDSU. And coming up, we'll have more Main Street.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Without a doubt, it's the most exciting church building going up in the last 100 years. Find out why Gaudí's Sagrada Familia is already the most visited site in Spain, even before it's finished.
Well, Gaudí wanted it to be his heaven on earth. It's as close as you get to heaven, I think.
And get inspired for making the most of your next trip.
It's a lost trip if you don't meet people.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. There's a lot of history yet to be uncovered and shared. That reality is what spurs historians to dig deep and discover new bits of the past to pass on to the future. Historian Tom Ezern voices our Plainsfolk essays, and today he shares the story of Tewakan, who was also known as Gabriel Renville.
A muggy day at the National Archives 2 years ago was the most disturbing day I ever spent in scholarly research. All day, I plowed through correspondence of military authorities in the Department of the Missouri, detailing actions, most of them obscure, in the latter stages of the Dakota War in Dakota Territory. The situation was confused and confusing. Armed conflict and refugee movements had scrambled previously discrete peoples of the Ocheti Chacoan into synthetic bands. Native and settler alike lived in continual terror of armed and roving companies who killed one another for inscrutable reasons. Thanks to a new book from the South Dakota State Historical Society Press, I now can reread my notes from that bad day in the archives and make better sense of them. There was, in the fog of war, someone with an emerging vision for a new people in a new place. That someone was Tiwakan, also known as Gabriel Renville. Now, there are faults to pick on in this book by Gary Clayton Anderson, entitled Gabriel Renville, From the Dakota War to the Creation of the Sisseton-Wahpeton Reservation, 1825-1892. Anderson, an exceedingly distinguished historian, knows Minnesota well, but the Dakota Territory, and not so much. He keeps calling it the Dakotas, which did not exist, of course, until 1889. He confuses the buffalo robe trade with the buffalo hide trade, two entirely different things, and he makes a shambles of the story of the Sibley Expedition of 1863, likewise the so-called Battle of Whitestone Hill. My remarks might be taken as touchiness on the part of a Dakotan, except that not getting such things, for instance the story of the Sibley Expedition at Big Mound in 1863, not getting them right obscures connections among later events. Renville, a Sisseton, led Sibley's Dakota scouts into camp on the alkaline lake we now call Kunkel, preventing a catastrophic battle by debilitating the soldiers' horses. He and the Christian Wahpeton, Little Paul Mazakutimani, figured in the crucial council that resulted in the shooting of Surgeon Josiah Weiser and ignited the war in the territory. I bring this up because these same two individuals, Renville and Mazakutimani, were antagonists and rivals in the subsequent history of the Lake Traverse Reservation, home today of the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate. In 1864-65, Renville and the scouts he recruited went to work for the Army, establishing a line of scouting outposts across eastern Dakota Territory, often fighting their own kinsmen. To their camps, however, gravitated hundreds of refugee Sisseton and Wahpeton. Renville wrote Sibley, "We like this country, and if we are to die, we will die here." It was a country centered on the Coteau des Prairies, the Prairie Coteau, a sublime range of hills that bisects the present North Dakota-South Dakota border. Renville's original scout camp was at a place the soldiers called Skunk Lake. Later usage has reverted to its Dakota name, Tiwakan, Gabriel Renville's name in his native language. It means a holy lodge, a sacred home. Here, Renville germinated the idea of a new homeland for his people, an idea he crystallized into the Treaty of 1867 and nurtured as principal chief at Lake Traverse. He perpetuated traditions of feasting and giveaways while at the same time nurturing agriculture and adaptation. His memory is ambivalent, but there is no doubt he was a man of vision.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about Governor Burgum's budget ideas. And we'll hear about a new documentary that tells the story of the North Dakota volunteers who fought in the Philippines during the Spanish-American War. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum had a chance to outline his proposed $14.3 billion budget before lawmakers this morning.
Our goal was to fund our priorities in a responsible way, replenish our reserves, and spend less than our ongoing revenues. Again, we have done that in this budget without raising taxes.
Along with finding greater efficiencies and less duplication in state agencies, Governor Burgum says the state will be able to improve an increase in salary for state employees.
This recommended increase in compensation also authorizes performance-based increases for high-performing team members. Agency and institution salary budgets are increased by 4% for the first year of the biennium and an additional 2% for the second year. Agencies that can identify long-term salary savings equal to 2% will be authorized to provide an additional 2% for salary increases in the second year, bringing the total authorized salary increase to 4% for each year, or 4 and 4.
Burgum says efforts must also be made to replenish the state's funding reserves. Those accounts had been heavily relied on for the current biennium. State lawmakers say they like a number of things Governor Burgum has in his executive budget proposal for the 2019 legislature, but some say they have some questions. Bismarck Republican Senator Nicole Poolman says she's happy Burgum included more money for K-12 education, raising it by 2% per year and a two-year period of no growth.
That's tough to do because not only do we need more funds for increased per pupil payments, but we have more pupils, right? We have many more children in the state. So to see that investment in public education, K-12 education, is exciting for me.
Poolman says she also likes the idea of reinstating the Challenge Grant Program for Higher Education. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Ray Holmberg of Grand Forks says Burgum's budget speech did leave some questions.
We presented the spending half of the budget process, but we have no idea what kind of revenue number he's working with. So that's one of the things that has to be explored over the next week.
And the Fargo Planning Commission, on a 5-4 vote, approved a zoning change on a revised plan for a major expansion of St. Paul's Newman Center block near the NDSU campus. It's a joint project of Roar's Development and the Fargo Catholic Diocese, who together own the older rental homes on the block, which will be demolished for the expansion. Parts of the original plan, including high-rise apartments, were opposed by homeowners in the surrounding Roosevelt neighborhood because of the loss of the houses and the impact high-density housing will bring to their area. Roar's responded by redesigning the project. Here's Vice President Larry Nygaard.
We think the redevelopment of the St. Paul Newman Center block is an incredible opportunity for the city of Fargo to really enhance a gateway entrance to the university and the Newman Center itself. It's an area that has been run down over the years.
Some residents say the proposed changes are a good start, but neighborhood spokesman Ken Enochson says there are still significant concerns about the project and whether this sets a precedent for similar projects.
We're left as the residents of these core neighborhoods with some questions. Where are the lines going to be drawn? What will be the guiding principles for future development? What is the city's vision for the Roosevelt neighborhood and other core neighborhoods? And finally, what voice will residents have in determining that vision?
Modifications include fewer apartments, lowering the height of the apartment buildings from 6 to 5 stories, and the addition of 13 townhomes on the east side of the block that would act as a buffer to other homes. The City Commission will have final say on whether the project can be built. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by our news director, Dave Thompson, by our microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
And as we just heard from Danielle Webster, the big story of the day in North Dakota is the governor's budget proposal.
Yes, this is always a big day because this sets the tone for the upcoming legislative session, which starts in January.
And how would you gauge the reception of the governor's budget proposal?
I'm going to say a bit of cautiousness. If I may use an analogy, it's kind of like two prize fighters in the ring in the first round. That Governor Burgum has proposed a number of things that a lot of legislators are acknowledging are innovative, but they say the devil's in the details.
And, of course, this is a predominantly Republican legislature. It's a supermajority, and the governor is a Republican, but there are differences in the opinions of the factions, if you will.
That's correct. And even the Democrats were more, I think, embracing his ideas. Senator Joan Heckman said to me that she saw a lot of what the Democrats had been running on in his budget. The Republicans I've talked to said their ideas worth considering, but if you'll notice, his speech was long on the spending proposals but short on revenue.
It was also,
but that comes later.
It was also long.
It was a long speech.
It started late and ran long, I guess.
Yes, it ran about 46 minutes. And a little anecdote, and I might as well pass it along. The legislative leadership had told me they were trying to hold the governor to a half hour. And they thought he had cut down to about 35 minutes, but he did go about 46.
Well, let's hit the big points here, because this is a $14.3 billion total revenue budget.
Total revenue budget, that's right.
And you're talking about $4.6 billion in ongoing general fund items. And by my figuring, because I was intrigued by this, federal funds represent more than a quarter of the recommended state budget. So that's,
sure,
that's a pretty important player these days, too.
If you do it, what the largest budget in state government is human services. A lot of that is federal funded.
And of course,
because that's, you know, Medicaid match and things like that.
And we have the extension service, all that kind
right,
of stuff.
Right.
Well, let's tick through the big ticket items. K-12 education funding.
Right. Remember, K-12 was held harmless in the last session, which is flat funding, but as anybody who knows, when you've got school districts with growing enrollment, hold even is not hold even. But now he's talking about an increase which is about 2% per year over the next 2 years. So it looks a little bit better. The Democrats, by the way, had proposed and they had pushed for a 3-3. But 2.2 is a nice starting point.
So how about the employees' wages? The state employees, there are almost 16,000 of them.
Right, and that includes the higher education. What people had talked about, and let me go through some of the history of that, there was a committee that recommended raises which would be 2% for each year of the biennium. There was a proposal from a Bismarck legislative cadre that said $300 for the first year and a 1% in the second year. Well, the Democrats came up with $300 in the first year and 3% the second year. And the governor has come up with his plan, which is 4% the first year and 2% plus possible another 2% in the second year.
Yeah, he's giving the agency heads some discretion here regarding
he
these
is.
Raises, isn't he?
Right. In the second year, he is. Actually, in the first year, he is, too, because he doesn't want a blanket across the board 4%. He says that should be up to agency head discretion about, you know, if they want to reward a very hard worker or somebody innovative.
Now, a very important part of this budget plan would tap the revenue or the, you know, the income from the legacy fund.
Right. Now, this is the earned income. It's not the principal, but the earned income from the legacy fund. As he mentioned our briefing last night, he said three times, we're not touching the principal. By the way, we're not touching the principal. By the way, we're not touching the principal. So he wanted to make sure that the principal still stays intact, but they're going to use some of the, you know, earnings from the legacy fund for some spending priorities. And, of course, there's this new proposal out there to do some, quote, legacy projects, end quote, which look kind of interesting, including what could be a bit of a controversial item going down the road is the Theodore Roosevelt Library.
Yes, because that has been a bit controversial. And
it is.
This would be to set it in Medora, I take it?
That is correct. To keep the digitization that Dickinson State's already doing, but to go along with what we've been hearing of some private donors are interested in putting it in Medora, so it would be a public-private partnership.
Well, the Legacy Fund has $6 billion in principal, and mm-hmm. he is proposing $300 million in legacy projects, that is from that income or revenue. That's 5% of the total, so it's not insignificant.
That's right.
But a big chunk of this, or a chunk of it, I should say, 10% of that, would be for unmanned aircraft systems or drones. This is an emerging industry in the state.
Right. If you're looking at a way to diversify North Dakota's economy, Governor Burgum has said, you know, we can be a leader, and we probably are a leader in UAVs because we have wide open spaces. And in terms of air traffic, there hasn't been a problem with air traffic. And, you know, North Dakota is probably a good place because you have the two Air Force bases and you've got colleges involved to, you know, really get going on drone research.
And $55 million for an infrastructure revolving loan fund for local entities. So is this like matching money or is this?
Well, well this would be a revolving fund would be, say you have a curb and gutter project in Fargo and it needs $15 million. You want to borrow it from that revolving loan fund. When you pay it back, that goes back in the loan fund for
okay.
another loan.
So, oh, I see.
So that's what he's proposing. Not a bad idea, a new innovative idea, and a way that he said will protect the state's bond rating.
That said, $55 million doesn't sound like a huge amount of money for infrastructure.
No, but we've got other things coming for infrastructure, including the Project Prairie Dog that's been talked about, that Senator Wardner's been pushing to use oil tax money to go into a permanent fund for funding infrastructure projects. So there's a lot of focus on infrastructure, if you want to put it. But since you brought up infrastructure, Doug, another interesting thing to me was this idea to take money out of what's called the Strategic Infrastructure Investment Fund, the SIF fund, and put it toward reducing the debt that the state retirement fund might be carrying.
Ah, because, you know, because cost of debt might be going up, huh?
That's right. And if you're talking about unfunded liability, if every state employee retired, the fund would be in the red. And they figure it's about $1 billion short from being completely, you know, solvent. And so he's taking about $285 million out of that fund, putting it in, and he said that's the seed money, and perhaps within 20 years, maybe like 18 years, the fund then would be solvent.
Well, I also note that the governor proposes $35 million in legacy fund to basically replace the state hospital at Jamestown.
That one took a lot of us off guard. I first heard about it last night at the governor's briefing that he had for reporters. And then I was talking to some of the people who have been involved in the behavioral health study. And they were taken off guard by that. And Kathy Hogan from Fargo, state senator, said it sounds like a very interesting proposal, but we need to know what that's going to look like, because he said he'd want to do a hospital and a clinic in Jamestown. And you close the old state hospital and make that part of the prison, part of the James River Correctional Center. So you repurpose that building, and by doing that, you move some people from the Missouri Valley Correctional Center, which is in Bismarck, and then you open that up to move the women who are in the Southwest Regional Correctional Center in New England, and they would move to Bismarck.
Okay.
So it's like a domino type thing.
But incarceration is still a growth industry. Is that the issue here too?
No, it's not so much a growth industry. But if you put more of these people who are incarcerated, who might just be having some addiction issues, if you put them on the campus of a new Jamestown State Hospital, well, they might be able to get the help they need. And we still have judges who say that they have sentenced offenders who have addiction problems to jail, because that's where they can get addiction treatment.
And this is a big issue with the governor and
it's
the First Lady,
issue.
Too.
It's
so let's talk
issue.
About health and human services and behavioral health stuff. Where's the money for that?
It is amazing because remember the Schulte report of 2013 talking about the needs, and they put about $7 million toward that. Well, now you've got a Justice Reinvented Fund that you know, they're talking about trying to keep people away from prisons. Then you've got this, you know, some other money that's become available because there's been some savings because of some efficiencies found in state government. And, of course, let's be honest, there was a buyout program for some of the more senior employees, and some of that money is being saved. So now you can invest some money, and I think it's between $17 and $19 million, and that investment probably will go up in subsequent bienniums.
Well, we did talk about state employee compensation, but let's talk about the retirement plan, because that might be a scrap.
It could very well be a scrap, because the governor has proposed so far to keep the retirement plan in place. Now, state employees and a lot of political subdivision employees are able to have a defined benefit plan. Well, there's always been this group, especially in the House, that wants to change that to a defined contribution plan. And that would put more of the risk on people who are going to invest in it. Full disclosure, we at Prairie Public have a defined contribution plan.
Yes, so lots of people
TIA,
do these days.
We do. But state government has the defined benefit plan. And there were proposals that were taken to this Employee Benefits Committee, and the Employee Benefits Committee said, no, we're not going to do that now. The chairman of that committee, Mike LaForce, said if we wanted to go down that road, it's going to take more of a study than just going from here's plan A, let's go to plan B, because there's a lot of moving parts in that. And the governor has said, okay, we're going to stick with that for the moment.
Well, the governor proposes, the legislature
disposes.
So when the legislature convenes in January, what do you expect them to propose?
That is going to be a very good question. I think they're already working on some stuff. But, you know, a lot of things are organic in a legislative session. They evolve over time. And, you know, Senator Ray Holmberg, the chairman of Senate Appropriations, said it right the other day. Said you'll get the budget from the governor, and they'll take it apart. And when it's put back together, the spending levels are pretty close. But what's within the spending levels could be interesting.
And, of course, the revenue stream is important. And there are a couple of question marks about that.
There are. And, of course, one thing I'd like to see is some figures broken out about what the effect of the new collecting sales tax from Internet sales is going to have.
Well, we'll be following all that with interest. The budget is very important to everybody.
It certainly is.
Dave Thompson is our news director. Thanks for checking in, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up next on Main Street, a student film about North Dakota soldiers during the Spanish-American War.
I'm going to have to sneak out of the house, all right? We're going to take your dad's car, we're going to go to prom, and hopefully you drop me off early. I'm going to sneak back into the house, and if my dad catches me and kills me, well, YOLO, you know what I mean? You live once. What an amazing way to go out, right?
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. The Prom, Secrets, The Winding Road to Citizenship, and more. Next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Angela Smith, an NDSU Associate Professor of History. Thanks for being with us, Angela.
Yeah, thank you.
And Carol Butcher, an NDSU Doctoral Candidate. Thank you for
thank
being
you.
With us. Also, somebody who writes Dakota Date books.
Yes.
Which will follow this segment. But we're going to talk about a new film that's been produced by, I guess, you among others.
Yes.
Called 1898-1899, North Dakota Goes to War. Angela, how did this film come to be?
Well, I have a project every fall for the digital history class, and I had been hearing so much about Carol's research that I decided I would take on a film for this fall, for this particular class. I'm the producer, Steve Beckerman, who works at NDSU but is also a musician and a filmmaker, is my partner in this project, and students have helped with research. They've consulted with Carol, and we put together a really good script, and we found the images to illustrate the history, and there you have it. And we open on Monday, so we're right on the verge of being completed with this project.
It premieres Monday, December 10th at 7 o'clock at the Fargo Theater. It runs about 45 minutes. Carol, this was inspired by a Dakota Date book?
Yes, it was. I did a short Dakota Date book post called Company B Rides Free about the adventures of the North Dakota troops in the Spanish-American War, how they ventured to the other side of the world and back again.
And they had trouble getting home when they got back again because they were dumped in where, San Francisco?
San Francisco. They were left in San Francisco and they had to have money to get home. And the good people of Fargo started raising money to bring their troops home. And that caught on across the whole state and other towns began raising money. And they brought their boys back home where they belonged.
Angela, like a lot of wars, the story gets a little muddled, at least when the war is being fought. How is this as an exercise to teach students about, you know, how things change with time?
It's an exercise in teaching, first figuring out the timeline. When did things happen? How did they happen? And the Spanish-American War is particularly confusing, which Carol, in a really wonderful interview that she did for the film, explains very nicely. And that the story itself, it has so many overlapping features, it was a challenge to try to figure out how do you unfold this so that the public understands.
Well, this war is prominent in North Dakota's history, Carol, because the state was just about like 8 years old or 9 years, 10 years old, I guess, when this was going on. So when you were writing your dissertation, and you're currently still writing it.
I am.
what particular facets of this story really struck you?
What jumped out at me was the independent spirit of North Dakotans. They saw something that was wrong. They approached the governor. The governor said he didn't have any money to bring the soldiers home. There was no state money available. And so the good citizens of North Dakota saw something that was wrong and decided to fix it. And they didn't wait for the Army to fix it. They didn't wait for the governor to fix it. They just took it upon themselves and they made it right. And I loved that story.
Well, famously, of course, Theodore Roosevelt, who would become president, organizes the Rough Riders. And he goes to Cuba, where part of the Spanish-American War is being fought, and has that Battle of San Juan Hill. But we're talking here about the Philippines, which was another Spanish stronghold.
Correct. The North Dakota troops went to the Philippines. They expected to get there, finish the war up within, a month or so, and then come home again. And they did finish up the war very quickly, but it turned into an insurrection when the Filipinos realized they weren't being liberated from Spain, they were being purchased from Spain. And they got a little cranky about that. And so the soldiers, instead of being gone for a month, were gone for 18 months before they could get home again.
And, of course, this is, you know, history that has a lingering effect because we're still in the Philippines.
The United States finally granted independence to the Philippines in 1946 after they acted as our very strong allies in World War II.
But we've had bases there and
yes.
We've had a strong military presence there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
This war, Angela, famously was in the papers at the time. William
yes.
Randolph Hearst, the yellow journalist who was a media mogul of his time, made a lot of the sinking of the battleship Maine.
Right.
And, of course, it looks like now, after history, that the Spanish had the better analysis of what actually happened.
Yeah. And Carol talks about this, too, in the film. She explains that it actually was something that went wrong with the ship, but we went to war anyway.
Yeah, because it wasn't a mine. It was something that blew up inside the ship.
Right.
Yes, the theory now is that it was an explosion in the coal bunker, which was right next to the ammunition storage.
Angela, this is all part of this digital history project that you do. Tell us about where we can find this and what kinds of other stories you've got up there.
Okay. When I first got here, I've been at NDSU for 7 years. I started the Fargo History Project. And in the course of this time, every year we add something to the website, whether it be a film, whether it be a walking tour. There are many stories told through the website and in conjunction with Bonanzaville or the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, who are my working partners. The stories there you can find out about the North Dakota Orphans Home. There's an article about that. Over the years, I've gotten many emails from people who are interested in finding out more about the Orphans Home. There's also downtown walking tour, a whole series of walking tours, the cemeteries, the fire of 1893, all kinds of good stories. Go and check it out at fargohistory.com.
And just one quick more question for you, Carol. I mean, the North Dakota Agricultural College, where a lot of these soldiers came from, was pretty small at that time. How big an impact was it on them?
It was a very big impact. There were about 200 students, and 23 of the cadets resigned from the college and joined the Army. And so that was a very noticeable emptiness at the college. And in fact, the college newspaper, The Spectrum, which was already publishing all the way back then, commented that it just took the life right out of the school.
Well, you can see the school back with how it looked over 100 years ago because Old Main is still here. And I urge you to check out 1898-1899, North Dakota Goes to War. It premieres Monday at the Fargo Theater at 7 o'clock. And Angela Smith, Carol Butcher, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bremer Investment Services, with dedicated financial advisors offering financial plans for a secure future now and throughout retirement. Bremer Investment Services, for what's ahead.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 5th. In 1881, a 21-year-old bachelor named Irving Gardner headed to Hope, North Dakota to homestead. As he later wrote, he was unprepared for what lay ahead of him. The train was a freight train with a few passenger cars and a caboose in the rear. After traveling about half the distance toward Hope, the passenger cars ran off the rails and bumped along the ties. We were going pretty slowly, and no one seemed much alarmed at first. But some of the men got up on the cars and tried to attract the attention of the engineer by yelling and waving coats. They had no success. The cars began to zigzag. The call was to jump off. I made the plunge into a snowbank and went in up to my waist. No sooner had I jumped than over went the cars on their sides. Gardner reported that a passenger beside him on the platform who hadn't jumped got buried in the wreck. Gardner pawed away the snow to free the man, who was still alive. With the help of others, the man was carried to a nearby house and cared for. Gardner's life on his new quarter section of land was at first discouraging. Burglars made a number of visits, first taking his blankets, then dishes, then tools and a clock. Each time Gardner would try to secure the house, but the burglars were persistent. Gardner finally got the doors and windows barred, but even that didn't end the problem. Gardner writes, "They climbed to the roof and pulled up the stovepipe. One night I was wet and tired and got home only to find my stove several feet short of pipe. But a young adventurer like me could not let that bother him. I had to do something, for it wouldn't do to let the smoke pour out into the room. So I pulled off a couple of boards from a partition and ran them from my bed to a table, lifted the stove to this higher level, and shoved the pipe through the roof again, started my fire, and in no time was all heated up and ready for business as usual." Like many others, Irving Gardner found the life of a homesteader wasn't what he expected. After proving up, he rented out his land and moved back to the East Coast, where he went into the insurance business. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
In a small town high up in the mountains of Puerto Rico, a cemetery devastated by Hurricane Maria is still closed.
I saw broken caskets. I saw skeletons. And there was the smell.
All this has forced some residents to exhume the bodies of their loved ones.
Mi corazón, mi alma,
my soul, my heart, my everything. They all told me we couldn't leave her like that.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, Jack Russell Weinstein joins us with a preview of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. On Sunday, he'll discuss police ethics with Luke Hunt of Radford University in Virginia. Our topic for Main Street Eats on Thursday with Sue Belcom is cranberries, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.